ahead and
got it.
Hi, I just got out of they had to pump the road, so.
Right. If you're not speaking, if you could put your phone on mute. And Dr. Malott, go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to go ahead and call the first meeting of the ARC meeting. Miss Heidi, do you mind telling me the date of the first one?
Certainly. I'll do a roll call, and then I will prompt you with each of the minutes. So,
okay, thank you.
My pleasure. So roll call Dr. Malott.
Here.
And Dr. Bohansky.
Present.
And Dr. Meyer.
Present.
The for the approval of minutes, the first set is dated March 30th, 2020, and we need a vote from Dr. Malott and Dr. Meyer.
Yeah.
Hello. So,
do I hear a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Motion carries. Meeting minutes approved. We move to the next one.
Yes, May 1st, 2020, Dr. Meyer and Dr. Bohansky.
Move to approve notes.
Second. I don't think, was I present at that meeting, Ms. Heidi?
No, Dr. Meyer and Dr. Bohansky. So we've got the motion and the second.
Dr. Myers, you're chairing that meeting, so go ahead and call the question.
So, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Notes
and
approved.
The next set is June 1st, 2020, Dr. Meyer and Dr. Bohansky.
I move to approve those notes.
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
I move to approve the August 7th notes.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Motion carries. Meeting minutes approved. Are we done with the full sets?
Yes, we just need a motion and a second and a vote to adjourn.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Approved. We adjourn.
All right. Thank you. I think we now can move into our regular meeting. The time now is 8:35, December 10th, 2020. I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychology.
I'm going to put it on.
Hosted on Zoom. The public and the parties on the agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with the meeting instructions. Ms. Poe, could we please have a roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Here.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Mr. Dinar? Dr. Gill?
Present.
Ms. LaBoy? Dr. Meyer?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Ms. Poe. Agenda item number 3, remarks and announcements. Please note that the time stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend a discussion of one item and proceed to a timed item and then return to the former item at a later time. The board also may reorder the timed items. The board encourages everyone in attendance to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. Please contact the staff if you'd like to get the link for that form. And also want to give a big shout out to all the board members for your hard work, for reading all these documents. I know it's a lot of work and time, and your efforts are very much appreciated. And also, of course, to the staff who prepare us and provide all the documentation, and our attorney, Ms. Galvin, who keeps me in line and on the straight and narrow of the legal aspects of everything. So we do appreciate all of you. And continuing education credits, if any of you would like to receive continuing education credits, please listen to the code word that will be provided throughout the meeting and mail those words to the board staff within 1 week in the meeting. Next item is recognition to Dr. Malott. Ms. Executive Director, would you like to provide?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. As the board might recall, it was about this time last year that we recommended, the board adopted a motion to nominate Dr. Malott for the most prestigious award that ASPPB bestows on its members, which is the Fellow Award. And so we learned at the annual meeting in October that Dr. Malott was one of two award recipients in the country to be named as a fellow. She is the second Arizonan to be named as such. So she shares that distinction with Dr. Bohansky. And assembled for you, Madam Chair, just some of the highlights from the nomination that we submitted.
Right, thank you. As a public member of this board, I have tremendous respect for the expertise and experience of Dr. Malott. She brings to this board a lot of experience and has been on the board for, I want to say forever, but I probably almost forever. She's a subject matter expert on multitude of topics, but what is most distinguishing is her vast and broad knowledge of the education and training requirements that are essential to prepare individuals for the practice of psychology. Dr. Malott has led the board in its efforts to continually update through administrative rule revisions the requirements for licensure as a psychologist. And due in large part to her engagement with and her leadership roles within ASPPB, Dr. Malott is well informed as a psychologist regulator on the topic. As a board member and as the chair this year, I very much value the unique strengths and contributions that all of you bring to this board. We are a strong board because of it. And with Dr. Malott, I find her unwavering dedication, thoughtfulness, and vision, as well as her ability to so nicely disagree when she disagrees with someone. And she's so well thought and very meticulous in her thought process, which I really appreciate. And she truly is a teacher in every way, not just that because she works at NAU, but she is a teacher. When I came on this board, I'm a public member. I came on with very little experience at all. And she was a great mentor. She was someone I could look at and, you know, ask questions to, and was very warm and welcoming, because I'm sure the first year I was asking really non-intelligible questions because I was just trying to grasp on. And yet she was such a warm and just a great mentor and a learning person for me. And I'll always appreciate that, Dr. Malott. I'm proud that she represents this board with her many engagements with ASPPB. Both organizations are stronger and definitely more effective because of Dr. Malott. So congratulations, Dr. Malott. We're all big round of applause. Woohoo! Yay, Dr. Malott. And would you like to say a few things, Dr. Malott? Any comments?
I'd like to say couple of things. First, I want to thank you for your very, very kind words. You've been an amazing public member and brought so much to our board. And thank all the board members. And especially, I want to thank Dr. Bohansky for making the initial nomination and really recognizing, you know, the last 15 years. This is my 15th year on this board. Mm-hmm. And it's been, you know, a lot of service, but really one that is meaningful. You know, we do a lot of service in our lives. This is such a meaningful work that we do to help future psychologists as well as current psychologists, you know, and protect the public. And I enjoy the work and really glad to have my little part in this whole thing. And I appreciate all of the work of the board members and your continued patience with me too. So as you get older and stay on the board a lot longer, you do get a little crankier, and I've noticed. I appreciate everybody, and I thank you for the nomination. So.
But you're cranky in such a nice, polite way. Thank you. Thank you. Deserved it. Would anyone else like to make a comment about Dr. Merlot? I know Dr. Mohansky, you threw in to help nominate her. Do you have any comments?
We couldn't have a better representative than Dr. Merlot, who brings counseling experience, school psychology experience, the entire educational background she has, and I am thrilled to have been part of this board with her for so many years. I've learned a lot, I appreciate, and I now call her the maven of psychology in Arizona. She has under her control one of the largest
making the old
programs, along with her school and counseling programs. This is truly Ms. Psychology, and I appreciate working with her.
Thank you, Dr. Mohansky. Very kind.
All right. Anyone else want to say a few words?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you also, Ramona, for helping me get used to some of our committees and the board. It's been, yes, and I really look up to you as representative of school psychology and academics in Arizona. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And Heidi, did anyone else?
This is Dr. Davey. I just want to thank Ramona, Dr. Merlot, for all of her assistance over the years, welcoming behavior analysts to the Board of Psychology, always treating all of our colleagues with the utmost respect, listening to our concerns and taking them to heart, and then always moving in a positive direction. So I just want to thank you from the behavior analysts that are represented by this board.
Thank you, Anthony.
And I'd like to thank you, Dr. Merlot, for your guidance and mentoring as I come onto the board, and you've been such a grateful member and supportive member.
Thank you, Dr. Myers.
Dr. Davis-Wilson, I think I saw.
Yeah, Dr. Merlot, I also wanted to thank you for your mentorship and guidance. It has been greatly appreciated over the years. It's been, I think, almost 10 years since I first started attending these board meetings. So through that time, being able to learn from you has been great. I also wanted to add, you know, Ms. Shreves mentioned your vast knowledge in the education and training requirements for the practice of psychology, but I think it's important to note that you do also oversee NAU's behavior analysis program as well. And so the knowledge that you have regarding our credentials and our education and training requirements is equally as vast as that of psychology. And so thank you very much for kind of balancing both sides of that as I'm sure it's a difficult task to remember it all.
Oh, Dr. Gill.
Yeah, I'd also like to congratulate Dr. Merlot. And as all of you know, I'm not that well trained in the training and education piece of how the board operates. And I appreciate Dr. Malott's feedback.
Thank you.
And getting me on board with the ARC. And I understand that will continue to be the case. So thank you very much.
Dr. Merlot, you are appreciated. We really, you're wonderful. This award was well-deserved. And we could ask for a nice person to get it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I think we had one more award that I think Executive Director, you wanted to mention?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm going to try to accomplish just that in a moment. Okay, here we go. So it is unusual for regulators to get any degree of recognition, but we're really fortunate to not only acknowledge Dr. Merlot's achievement, but we learned, I think it was just yesterday, that ASPPB sent to Dr. Bohansky a very specific award to recognize his unique and pioneering efforts to launch what is SIPAT, the Interjurisdictional Compact for psychology. I think that it is well understood that thanks to Dr. Bohensky securing Arizona as the first state in the compact, it was because of those efforts that other states followed. So, you know, without that leadership and, you know, that groundbreaking effort, we probably wouldn't be talking about the existence of an interstate compact today. So Gene was fortunate to have this opportunity to capture this moment when Dr. Bohensky received his award. And I think there's I've got a close up. Here we go. So you can read the text. So SciPact is honored to present this recognition to Dr. Bohensky for being the instrumental voice and power behind Arizona that made it the first state to enact SciPact and for serving as SciPact's first commissioner. So congratulations to Dr. Bohensky.
Wow, congratulations, Dr. Bob. Well, it's well deserved.
Thank you very much. I was surprised.
There's a lot of clapping for both you and Dr. Malott today. It's kind of hard to do on Zoom, but it's there in our hearts. All right, we're going to move
on. You're doing a great job, Mishri.
Oh, thank you. We're going to go on to item 4, call of the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board may limit those persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number on the public comment matter. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to Arizona Revised Statute 38431.02H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. Ms. Poe, could you unmute anyone that has requested or would like to speak to the board?
Ms. Shreve, Madam Chair, we do have one member that contacted board staff, Dr. Haggard. If he is on the line, he would like to do a call to the public.
And does he need to unmute or how?
He should be able to unmute himself. Dr. Haggard, are you on the line?
I am.
Dr. Haggard, welcome to the board meeting. We're glad to have you today. Did you have a few comments for the board? Again, we can't respond to them. This is a public meeting call.
Yes, I do have some comments.
Please go ahead.
First, congratulations to Dr. Malott and Dr. Bohensky. I do appreciate their service. I am a third generation functional medicine practitioner, had a bachelor's degree in biology from ASU at age 19, was in the U.S. Army, received the Soldier of the Cycle Award in Fort Benning, Georgia, received the Honor Graduate Award in the pharmacy program, and was one of the youngest naturopathic students to ever graduate with a doctorate of naturopathic medicine. Now I want to tell you about John Denbor. John Denbor has harmed thousands of people with his license to practice psychology. While on probation with this board, he has harmed the public in every aspect of being a psychologist. Denbor has formal complaints to this board from multiple clients, coworkers, insurance companies, and other psychologists. However, thousands of complaints should have been made. I am addressing this board today to speak for those who did not complain, especially the elderly and mentally impaired that Denbor preyed upon. I have provided this board with thousands of pages of documents that show indisputable evidence that John Denbor has committed thousands of instances of copyright fraud, insurance fraud, and scientific misconduct for personal gain. Denbor used his license to practice psychology in an unethical, unrespectable, and inappropriate way, and this board should not hesitate to revoke it. It is absolutely absurd that after 11 formal board complaints, Denbor has shown no remorse for any of the people affected by his actions. I understand the mission of this board is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of Arizona citizens. But this case goes beyond Arizona citizens. Denbor previously had a license to practice psychology in California and has expressed interest in obtaining one in Wisconsin. John Denborn was issued a license to practice psychology in California on March 19, 2013. Then less than 6 weeks later, on April 30th, 2013, he omitted on his Arizona psychologist application for license renewal form that he was currently licensed as a psychologist in another jurisdiction. Denbor has no conscience when filling out applications and forms or making claims. He has provided completely false information on many documents that I have already provided many to this board, including his smart memory program books, loan applications, insurance applications, bank account applications, Arizona Corporation Commission filings, and IRS documents, resulting in false copyright claims, unsupported claims his stolen smart memory program prevents dementia, scientific misconduct, identity fraud, loan fraud, bank fraud, wire fraud, insurance fraud, and fraud to people in believing he is a neuropsychologist. Who is to say he won't omit all his troubles in Arizona when applying for a license in another state? The evidence of Denbor's repeated unprofessional conduct is so overwhelming and widespread that I urge this board not to give John Denbor the opportunity to harm anyone else in any other state. The easiest way this board can deal with this situation is to accept his surrender. But in a few years, he could start all over again and harm thousands of more people in another state. This is one of those situations where the easiest way is not the right or correct way. I spent approximately the last 2 years working with and then investigating John Denbor. The more I looked, the more unbelievable, illegal, unethical, and unprofessional conduct I found in areas I never suspected. For example, he had hundreds of purchased and legitimate DRS-2 forms in his office, but still directed and convinced his staff members to only use illegal photocopies. Denbor has no integrity or problem breaking the law, even when there is little to no incentive to do so. I know the degree of accusations I'm making, yet I have no concern of Denbor suing me for defamation because I can prove everything I say today. I understand this board could avoid informal interviews for 5 more complaints today by accepting Denbor's license surrender, but I am intimately familiar with all of these remaining complaints. Avoiding these informal interviews would leave many illegal, unethical, and unprofessional conduct unaccounted for, circumvents justice, and deprives the complainants of resolution. This board's actions today should not be temporary, but ensure John Denbor does not practice psychology in the future anywhere in our nation and hopefully the world. The only way to accomplish this is to revoke John Denbor's license to practice psychology.
Thank you for your comments. Again, we can't respond to them because it's due to law, but we do appreciate your comments. All right, moving to item number 5, council update. Ms. Galvin, do you have an update for us?
I do, Madam Chairman. Just one case involving Dr. Sade. You will recall that the board issued her an order for probation and practice monitoring. She has appealed that to the Superior Court. Her attorney has filed a motion seeking permission from the court to introduce additional evidence, and we have filed a response to that motion. Dr. Sade's reply should begin within the next week or so, and then the court will rule on that motion. And then we will proceed from there if they get to introduce more evidence. I suspect that that motion is going to be denied, and then we will brief the merits of the case, and I will keep you posted.
Great, thank you. Thank you for speaking. I would appreciate it. We're getting a lot of feedback on our system here. All right, moving to item number 6 is the consent agenda, discussion, consideration, and possible action. For the record, is there any recusals from the consent agenda from anybody? Hearing none, the board may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Is there a request to remove an item? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve the items?
So moved.
And a motion, a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 I hear one aye. Everybody else? Gotta take yourself off mute.
Aye.
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 Thank you. Aye. Thank you. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Thank you. I'm going to move to item 14, which is a very short item. I want to take first discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding the reapplication from Angus McKay. Ms. Executive Director, are you providing a summary on this, or Jennifer?
I understand that Dr. Malott is actually going to be addressing this agenda item, and if she needs assistance from Ms. Folks, I know she's prepared to help as well.
Dr. Malott, can you, would you like?
Can we do it in a second? I'm just loading it up. So.
Okay. Let me go to.
Did you hear me? Will
yes.
You hear me?
Yes, you said you need a minute. Ms. Michelson, can
yes.
Brief. Okay, would you rather have Ms. Folks just provide a summary?
That would be great, and then I can speak to it.
Perfect. Ms. Folk, would you like to provide a summary?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Agnes McKay, she submitted a reapplication with a request for accommodations. She has taken the ECCC twice, and this is her third reapplication or third request or second reapplication, third request to take the ECCC. The accommodations are medically related. And obviously we're not going to discuss the diagnosis, but there is a provider letter, and the request is for a separate room in which to take the exam.
Thank you. Dr. Malott, any comments?
This is Dr. Malott. Yeah. No, I think, you know, the request sounds reasonable, and I am the...
Is there a motion to approve
I'd like to make a motion to approve the request.
Okay, thank you. Is there a second?
I made the motion. I just need a second.
All right, thank you. I need a second. Dr. Karina?
Seconded.
Okay, Dr. Meyer, thank you. So we have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passed. We're now going to move to the timed item. The board may vote to go on. This is item number 7, discussion, consideration, and possible action relating to the initial. This is an initial case study review. The board may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to 38431.02A2 to review confidential records, including the receipt and discussion of information or testimony that is confidential by state or federal law, and ASRS 38431.03A3 to receive confidential legal advice from our attorney. The complaint is number 2103. It is now 9:01, and we are moving into this complaint with Dr. Robert Maskin. And Dr. Myers, you are the lead. Would you like to provide a brief summary?
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a quick question for Dr. Mastikian. I have reviewed and used your reports in my position at Disability Determination Services. I don't see a conflict of interest, but am willing to recuse myself if you have any concerns about my involvement.
No, I have no concerns.
Okay. And second of all, do you want me to review your initial response to the complaint or just focus on the letter submitted by your attorney last week, or both?
I think both will be best.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. We received a complaint in on September 1st from KP in response to a report that was provided to KP's ex-husband that was focused on contentious family court proceedings regarding their minor sons since 2014. They were ultimately divorced in 2017. On May 6, 2019, Dr. Mastikian conducted a consultation with the ex-husband and then summarized his consultation, which is the source of the complaint. KP indicated, KP interviewed the ex-husband and then made a consultation summary that was submitted to the court on May 13th, 2019. In the consultation, Dr. Mastikian stated that there appears to be enough evidence to conclude that KP may have underlying conditions that have contributed to a variety of psychological problems and behaviors, which could be signs of specific mental disorders. And it was strongly recommended that KP complete a more comprehensive psychological evaluation to assess for several mental disorders. Dr. Mastikian made recommendations solely based on false information provided by the ex-husband. Dr. Mastikian never met with KP. The consultation summary is full of false information about several items. The consultation summary was provided to the court by the ex-husband, which resulted in ex-husband requesting that KP undergo a psychological evaluation. KP has never been diagnosed with a mental illness, nor has it ever been suggested that she seek psychiatric services other than in Dr. Mastikian's consultation summary. KP states that she has no mental illness of any kind, and that the ex-husband has made similar accusations against KP to other providers. Dr. Mastikian responded in a timely manner, noted that requested that this complaint be dismissed because the same issue was addressed following a previous complaint based on an unrelated consultation summary. And in October 2019, the CSC reviewed the complaint and voted to dismiss the matter. In regards to this current consultation summary for this case, Dr. Mastikian states that it was issued in accordance with 901C of the APA Code of Ethics, and states that the summary is not meant to be used as a definitive diagnostic tool, and it is based on information provided by the ex-husband. Notwithstanding the CSC's decision that no violation of professional rule or statute had occurred for the previous complaint. However, the CSC expressed concern over the language used in the underlying consultation summary, and immediately following the dismissal of complaint, Dr. Mastikian voluntarily and proactively took the following actions to ensure that he was not engaging in any conduct that could be remotely construed as improper. He stopped providing consultation summaries in connection with family law proceedings and has not engaged in that type of work since the 10 October 2019 meeting. He also went back and revised the draft consultation summaries that he had previously prepared to address the concerns articulated by the CSC. Dr. Mastikian shared that for this case, he was concerned about the safety of the children and agreed to review KP's interactions with the children after submitting the May 6, 2019 summary. Dr. Mastikian provided a revised consultation summary on August 6, 2019, and again on another revised version on October 23rd, 19. He submitted these revised consultations to the attorney. In response to the allegations, Dr. Mastikian states that the consultation summary did not violate any professional standard. It is premised on the information reported by the ex-husband. Based on the information he provided, certain psychological conditions that could be consistent with the conduct described by the ex-husband are identified within the summary by Dr. Mastikian. KP takes issue with the fact that Dr. Mastikian never spoke or met with her. However, the Section 9 of the APA Code of Conduct recognizes that a psychologist may, in certain circumstances, issue an assessment or report without an individual examination. The 5-6-19 consultation summary explained that the opinions therein were not diagnoses and were not to be used as a diagnostic tool. And includes such explanations, identifies the report's limitations, and contains a disclosure regarding the source of information on which the information is based. And this does not violate the APA Code of Conduct or any board rule or statute. KP was never Dr. Mastikian's client, and contrary to her complaints, she was not to complete any psychological assessment as a result of the consultation summary. When questioned about this issue by board staff, KP disclosed that she agreed to additional psychological testing without a motion from the court. Ex-husband could have requested a psychological evaluation of KP based on the conduct he reported to Dr. Mastikian in regard to protection of the children. The fact that Dr. Mastikian agreed to consider the conduct reported by ex-husband to ascertain whether the behavior could be consistent with a psychological condition should not expose Dr. Mastikian to disciplinary action, particularly when the consultation summary complies with applicable professional and ethical standards. In conclusion, Dr. Mastikian reports that similar to the previous complaint, this complaint does not represent an instance of unethical or unprofessional conduct. He did not diagnose KP, and he noted that this was not to be used as a diagnostic tool. He disclosed that the ex-husband was the source of information. The 5-6-19 consultation summary for this case was issued prior to the 10-23-19 CSC meeting, and he voluntarily revised it upon receiving feedback from the CSC, and he has stopped providing these types of services. In November 18th, 2020, at the CSC review, it was determined that there may be a possible violation of ARS 32-2061-16DD, violating ethical standards adopted by the board as it pertains to Section 9.01, basis for assessments. Subsequently, Dr. Mastikian's lawyer submitted another letter, a response last week, which reiterated similar information. In summary, that this is similar to the previous complaint and should be dismissed, that it was a consultation, not an assessment. They did not provide a diagnosis. And that Dr. Mastikian practiced according to APA ethics. And that concludes my summary of the case.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. KP, are you, I believe you're on the Zoom call.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Thank you for being here today. We do really appreciate it. I wanted to give you an opportunity to say some opening comments if you'd like. And also after that, the board members may have some questions for you.
Okay. I'd just like to mention a couple of things. This report was admitted into court in an evidentiary hearing on May 13, 2019. This was the original report. This was not a revised report or anything like that. This report was also provided to Dr. Shalley, Dr. Bowalda, and others regarding our case. I know opposing counsel had used this recommendation to recommend an independent psychological examination. Obviously, these things are very time consuming, very costly. And I'd also like to add, if the doctor was concerned about the safety of the children, he first consider who he needs to protect the children against, rather than just believe everything father said. There were three CPS complaints by Ben's providers against his father, including his behavioral therapist and two others. I have the report here. I believe everyone has the report. I don't think it's necessary for me to give a summary of the report that the doctor wrote.
That's correct. We do have the report.
Okay.
Are there any questions from the board members for KP? Dr. Gill?
Yes, just for clarification purposes, KP, I know that you submitted a second complaint. What was the background that led to your second complaint?
Dr. Gill, just to clarify, KP has not submitted a second complaint. The first complaint that Dr. Mostikian's attorney is referring to was filed by a different party.
My error. Okay. I see. Okay. I'll let that go. Thank you.
Hey, Pete, I have a few questions. And you, I just want to confirm you did not meet with Dr. Miskowski.
No, I never met with him, never spoke with him. I never knew anything about him until this evidence was submitted to the court.
Okay. And due to his comments, then you then ended up taking a psychological exam. Is that correct?
Assessment. That's correct. And it's also been used in court proceedings and things like that.
Okay. And just to confirm, the original memo, I guess, or assessment that the doctor put together without the edits or that was what was submitted to the court originally. Is that correct?
That's correct. On May 13th, 2019 was that hearing.
All right. Thank you. Other board members?
Dr. Bob. KP, how was this document used in court?
It was used in court to try to help father in the court proceedings, basically.
And what was the result of it?
It's hard to say how the judge read things and, you know,
was the result of it that you had to undergo a psychological evaluation?
The hearing on May 13th was not related to this. As far as the independent psychological examination, that came up later on. Father brought up the idea of the independent psychological examination later on, separate from the hearing on May 13th.
So this report in and of itself did not force an evaluation or cause any change?
It's hard to say. I don't know about the word force. My attorney told me that the court could basically force an independent psychological examination, and there's really no reason for me to spend a lot of money and trying to not have an independent psychological examination. And also one reason I and willing to do the independent psychological examination is to clear all of these accusations in this report to show that things, you know, that these things are not true, that that father's trying to use against me and, you know, determining more parenting time and legal decision making.
So separate and apart from his report, you chose to undergo an independent evaluation and stake out your position.
Right. But yes, but I really don't think this would have been an issue without this report.
Okay. So you believe this report led to your need to undergo an independent evaluation?
Yes, I do believe that it led to the need for that. I also do believe that it led to opposing counsel suggesting that I go through an independent psychological examination.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions from the board members?
This is Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Meyer.
KP, thank you for being here. my question is, at the evidentiary hearing on May 13th, 2019, what was the outcome of that hearing?
That hearing regarded a number of issues, father being in contempt of court for a few items, father, you know, not paying a number of items, father trying to get Ben involved in extracurricular activities that numerous providers suggested he not be involved in. So there were, you know, probably a half a dozen items brought up in that evidentiary hearing. So father brought up this document just to make me look less credible overall in court.
And so the Dr. Mystikian's report from May 6th was entered into evidence at that hearing?
It was, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? All right, and just a reminder, we want to refer to the complainant and any of their children are by initials only. So again, so thank you, KP. We're now going to move to Dr. Mystikian. I know I'm mispronouncing it. If you can introduce yourself, and also I do believe you are you have counsel with you, if you'd like them to introduce themselves.
Yes, Dr. Mystikian. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, members of the board. I'm Natalia Ter-Gregorian. I represent Dr. Mystikian. Great. And we would like a brief opportunity to just make a quick statement to the board.
Please do.
So Dr. Mystikian issued two consultation summaries in May of 2019, and that both of the summaries were issued in accordance with Section 9.01C of the APA Code of Conduct. Both included language explicitly indicating that it was not a diagnostic tool. Neither summary contained any diagnosis, and both summaries also explicitly identified the limits and the scope and the source of the information that was relied upon in reaching the qualified conclusions and opinions in the reports. We attended a complaint screening committee last October 2019. And even though the complaint was dismissed, that was substantially similar to the complaint in this case, Dr. Mystikian voluntarily, based on comments from one of the board members in terms of how the language in the consultation summary could be improved upon, took those comments to heart and went ahead and voluntarily revised it within a week. Now the original May 2013 summary already complied with the standards set forth in the APA Code of Conduct. And I think we have sufficient information in the record indicating that the court did not rely on the May 2019 summary to KP's detriment, because there was no psych eval issued based on that. She agreed to that based on privileged communications with her attorney that we don't have the opportunity to really vet and look into. And I would also like to point out that Dr. Mystikian's focus when conducting this particular consultation summary wasn't just this amorphous concern for children. It was specific to the fact that one of the party's children had been diagnosed with a genetic disorder and therefore had special needs, and whether or not mother suffered from any mental health conditions or exhibited any behavior that may be consistent with a mental health condition that interfered or undermined her ability to care for this child. With respect to the CPS board referenced by KP, that was not provided to my office, but I do not have any information indicating how the Department of Services, Child Protective Services, resolved that initial report, whether or not it was substantiated or unsubstantiated. But it appears that it was unsubstantiated if the substantiation wasn't provided to the board. I think given the fact that even prior to the revisions, there was sufficient language within that May 2019 summary to entitle it to the, you know, it came within the scope of the exception 9.01 B and C. And for those reasons, coupled with the fact that KP voluntarily agreed to the psych eval, we do believe that a dismissal is appropriate. One other note, so I believe in the summary, I believe it was when KP was addressing the board, she indicated that the May 2019 summary was provided to Dr. Shally, who is another mental health professional that was retained by AP's attorney to review the record and kind of have a similar issue some sort of a similar report without an examination of KP. And if you actually look at the letter, I believe it was August 3rd, 20, the letter to AP's attorney, it actually identified the records viewed was the summary. And based on the record, so that was summary issued on October 30th, 2019. And after reviewing the records, a separate mental health professional similarly concluded that additional psychological evaluation would be necessary, that even based on the CAA report and some examination conducted by Dr. Moran, that in light of the records available to Dr. Shally, that it was important to reassess mother, and there was sufficient reason and good cause to reassess mother to determine whether or not there were any mental health conditions that could be ruled in or ruled out. So based on all of the above, I don't think it's appropriate to attribute to Dr. Mastikian harm when KP agreed to the psychological evaluation and when the concerns in the May 2019 summary were actually shared by a subsequent mental health professional that reviewed the revised summary and all the other records attendant to this case.
Thank you for your comments. Board members, do you have questions for the doctor?
It's Dr. Meyer.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you, Dr. Mastikian. So in reviewing the records, the corrections or revisions you made in August and October provide much clear messaging about the assessment that was done. My concern is that the initial assessment was provided and seems insufficient in your explanation for the evaluation that you conducted. And that was entered into evidence at a hearing, and we can only make assumptions about the ramifications of that initial report. One of the concerns I have is that towards the end, in that initial report, you state that the report is based on the available information, which was primarily provided by ex-husband. So it leaves it open to information was obtained elsewhere as well. Can you speak to that statement, the facts of that, as well as the implications of leaving that open?
Excuse me. I think in hindsight, the wording could have been a little different there. I should have said solely provided by the father. Again, since the last time we met, I made sure and I took to heart everything that the board members made reference to during the CSC to change the language of everything going forward, even though that and I want to refer back to the prior consultative summary had language which was not yet modified. This particular one was done prior to meeting with the board, and in hindsight, I think changing that word from primarily to solely, considering we were never provided with any records by the attorney or the father, I think it could have been, the wording could have been better. I could have had a better choice in wording to keep that a little more closed as opposed to leaving it open.
Okay. The other statement that seems confusing is at the beginning, the one caveat that you provided was that the summary is meant to serve as a screening tool to assess for possible severe mental health conditions. It is not meant to be used as a definitive diagnostic tool. Despite saying it's not meant to be used as a definitive diagnostic tool, how do you interpret the aspect, the wording that it says it's a tool to assess for possible severe mental health conditions?
Again, the wording, I will say this, the purpose of the consultative evaluation, but
could you start over? You froze, or I froze for just a second.
Okay. I believe the purpose of the evaluation, not the evaluation, but the consultation, was the objective was to make sure this father who had definite concerns, severe concerns about allegations about the mother that he believed were negatively impacting his special needs child's growth and safety. I considered this an opportunity to hear the father out, gather as much information as I could, and then provide an opinion at the end of this without providing a diagnosis, while providing information saying that the information was based on the father's reporting, and to give the father and his attorney at the time enough information to say that there may or may not be a problem here that could be endangering the needs of his special needs child. That's the purpose of this. I made it as clear as I believe it was clear that it was not, I didn't provide a diagnosis. I didn't want to, it wasn't supposed to be used as a comprehensive psychological evaluation of the mother. But I just wanted to be a tool that could get the information that the father had concerns about to his attorney and then subsequently to the powers that be to then can make the decision. I'm sorry, I'm losing my voice. I apologize if that was not clear.
No, we got that. Thank you. Besides talking to the ex-husband, did you attempt to obtain confirmatory information from any other source?
We requested records from his attorney numerous times. We never received anything. I did not reach out to the mother because I didn't see a need to at the time, considering the contentiousness of the proceedings and having having some history with working with the courts in juvenile dependency cases and some family cases. I wasn't expecting, if I did reach out to the mother, I wasn't expecting her to admit to all of these things. In either event, I still would have had to submit that consultation summary, even if I had spoken to the mother, which I wasn't expecting her to say all these things were true.
Okay, those were all my questions. Thank you.
I have a question.
Okay, Dr. Catarino?
So this was the father contacted you directly for this consultation summary?
The father's attorney referred him to me to do a consultation summary.
So if your goal was to be sure that the children, especially the special needs child, were in a safe environment, would you say?
Yes.
Did you, and I saw when I read it, it mostly talked about the father talking about the mother. Did you look at the father as possibly not being a protector or safe caretaker for the children?
Throughout the interview, it was done telephonically. I'm obviously looking for safety issues with both people, but the father presented very well. He's well-educated. He didn't show any signs of emotional instability. He's quite cognizant, very clear-minded. And and then he provided the information. And I didn't see any reason to believe that he was a direct threat or of harm to the children. But again, this is a very contentious case. So, everyone's going to be putting their best foot forward. But I've done these evaluations for many years. I've been 20 years. I've been working with children and families, doing evaluations and treatment and outreach and whatnot. And I just did not believe, strictly based on his presentation on the phone, that he posed any direct threat to the children. But again, I didn't have any records from these alleged DCS cases or allegations against the father. None of that was provided.
No, most of the history was the father, as I recall, giving information about the mother's past. And I didn't see much about his past or his background.
Well, I didn't assess him. The consultation was strictly his reporting on his concerns about the mother.
Okay. All right, that's all.
I do have a few questions for you, Doctor. You said the father's attorney referred him to you. Has that attorney referred other clients to you to do this type of assessment?
Yes, a couple of other people, yes.
All right, and like a one-way assessment where the one party's giving you information about the other?
Yes.
And do you think that in these kind of contentious custody situations that potentially people may exaggerate or not provide the correct information?
It's always possible, yes.
And so if someone were to call you and say to you, hey, Tammy Shreve is this and this and this, and I have concerns about this and this, you would just write that up as it said and with disregard to me or my position.
I'm sorry, can you rephrase that, ma'am?
I don't need to rephrase it. I'm quick. If somebody calls you, I'm using me as an example, and says, this is my concerns about Ms. Shreve, and this is a situation, and these are the concerns, you would just take that information and then expand and take their word for it and write something for the court.
I would put in the summary that would draft, obviously, that it was the information was solely based on this information provided by this individual. If that individual provided records, I would also make reference to the records.
Okay, so I'm looking at your memo, and it's the closing paragraph says, this possible personality disorder may have its foundation in her untreated blah, blah, blah. I don't want to go into as such, it's strongly recommended that she, the mother, complete a complete comprehensive psychological evaluation to assess a, and then it gives a psychological condition, and then it gives a psychological disorder. So you, in essence, are expounding the exact concern or psychological condition you think this person has without meeting them. Is that correct? Am I reading that correctly?
The concern that the father had is that the mother had mental health issues. He made reference to her having a trauma history and some other issues that she has been dealing with over her lifetime. When I wrote that portion up at the end, I wanted to conceptualize just a paragraph as to you know, strictly based on all the stuff that was written above that statement, that there may be issues that could be contributing to specific mental health issues that should be further explored during a more comprehensive evaluation.
Right, but you identify specific mental health conditions.
I did, yes, but I didn't diagnose her with them.
Well, you recommend that, yeah, but that you pretty much, in some ways, you're saying that this possible personality disorder may have a foundation. You already say she has a personality disorder in there.
No.
This possible personality disorder.
Okay, to be clear, that wording was very similar to comments made to the prior non-related issue in the prior complaint. Since then, I've changed all the wording and I submitted a revised version of this particular report a week after. So that was given to the attorney and then again to the father. So I did my best to replace it with information. And I believe the last complaint had similar language, but it was considered not a violation of the code or the standards of the APA. And I still took it upon myself to review all the other ones, change the language, take that out and revise it a more comprehensive, less, I don't even know what the word I'm looking for.
So
wording that doesn't have that diagnosis to it.
Okay. So you edited it after you sent her the original, after you sent the father the original one that was used in court. So in the past, you said you have done these types of evaluations before where they're one-sided with someone, the attorney telling their client to contact you because you'll do these one-sided evaluations. So was this type of wording used in your past evaluations?
They were, but then they were all revised. They were all revised and they were updated and sent to the attorney.
Could you can see where there's concerns maybe with people that it's one-sided and you're making these potential mental health judgments about somebody that you haven't even met in a contentious custody evaluation where you know as a professional I assume that maybe it could be one-sided or have certain views.
I do see the concerns, and I did see the concerns last year, which is the reason why I revised everything and I stopped doing these evaluations with family court. And I haven't done anything since last July. Not only with family court, but there are other types of evaluations where people will reach out to us or myself to where they're asked for, hey, I've got a concern. And I consult with them and write up a summary. And then if it's, they need it, they can use it. But I guess the code says in certain circumstances, we don't have to have any face-to-face contact with the other individual. The objective was to make sure that this father's concerns about the special needs child were addressed. And the father's, when he came in, the father's issue was not trying to point fingers at the mother per se. That's not the impression I got completely, but his genuine concern was the special needs child and the genetic condition that he has and the concerns that he's had over the years to where his physical or his physiological needs are not being met. And his physical health is being possibly jeopardized because of issues that other doctors have also said the mother may have as well.
But that's based on your hearsay from the father, right?
Yes, yes.
All right, any other questions from the board members? Dr. Gill?
Yes.
I'm Dr. Gill and then Dr. Malott.
Thank you, Dr. Mostakian, for being here. I think your defense is pretty solid with the exception of your use of diagnostic impressions. And even though you're saying that you didn't render a diagnosis and this report that you submitted is not a diagnostic tools, nevertheless, you put into your report diagnostic impressions. And the concern I have about that is that the court is going to read that report and they're not going to make that kind of distinction. They're not going to see it as, oh, it's not a diagnosis. They're going to see your diagnostic impression, and at least by potential, they might determine that there may be some merit to these impressions that you submitted in the report. I think everything else that you did, I don't have a problem with. I think your use of those diagnostic impressions in your report is my biggest concern. Do you have any comments about that, about why you use those impressions, the diagnostic impressions?
Well, again, I go back to the information Dr. Bohansky provided and Dr. Mayer also provided during the last time we met, the following last year. And the prior consultation summary, which was dismissed, had similar language. And it was considered not a violation. It was dismissed. But I took to heart what both parties said, and it made a lot of sense. And to this day, I still use that kind of language, more benign language, without using particular, you know, issues or language that I use in this one particular summary, which I again revised 7 days after I met with the board last year. And I immediately said, you know, this is, you know, absolutely vital. We have to change this. And I did it immediately. And I sent them all back to the attorneys and told them immediately, replace the ones you had before, replace it with this one, strictly based on what the board advised. Because I truly believe there was a lot of, you know, importance of what the board, you know, told me throughout the prior board meeting, despite the fact that I wasn't like mandated to change anything. And it was definitely a learning opportunity. And since then, everything has changed, and I'm very proud of that.
Thank you, Doctor.
Of course.
Dr. Malat?
Thank you, Ms. Sharif. I had a question for Dr. Mastakian. What is the purpose of the consultation summary? You said you're not doing a diagnosis. You're interviewing the father and basically providing, kind of regurgitating the information you received from the father. Obviously, as a psychologist, you're qualified to, you know, you've been trained to ask the right type of questions, but it's still a very one-sided evaluation. So I'm just trying to figure out the purpose of these consultation summaries. And the only thing that comes to my mind is you're using the title of a psychologist, which is a respected title by courts, to add kind of credibility to what the father is saying. So maybe you can help me understand.
Of course. The purpose of the consultation summary, the attorney that I've worked with before on a handful of other cases, they want to clear some sort of guidance as to whether they should, there was actual concerns which would warrant a more comprehensive, filing a motion for a more comprehensive evaluation with the courts. The father was referred over to me to discuss his concerns about the mother and concerns he had about the mother and her ability to take care of this to the special needs child. And again, I've only done a handful of these, and I haven't done any more since then. And the purpose was to make sure that I heard the father, understood what he was saying, and then provide a summary to the attorney to see if they wanted to go through asking for the mother to complete a more comprehensive evaluation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Katerina?
So would you consider this, what you say, a more comprehensive evaluation? So what you did was a less comprehensive evaluation?
I apologize. My wording was wrong. The purpose of the consultation summary, it's a consultation. The consultation itself was to determine whether a comprehensive evaluation would be warranted to rule out or assess for any other issues which could potentially harm the child lay some credibility, not some credibility, but lay some understanding about the mother's mental health conditions and whether the children would be at risk for harm.
So because, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. My wording was poor. This was not an evaluation. This was just a consultation.
Because if it were an evaluation, there's the APA guidelines on custody evaluations where you need to get information from more than one source, and you should be objective and interview both. So that's why when you said more, I was wondering. The other point that Dr. Gill made in the first eval, you didn't quite say this is the diagnosis, but I did see like these points are consistent with such and such diagnosis. It looked to be like you were implying that there could be a diagnosis, but I did not see that in the final report at the October one or November, whatever the last one.
So, as I referenced earlier, I took everything to heart from the prior meeting with the board. It's really shed a lot of insight, and we're all learning as we go. And there's never a learning point where you stop learning. So there's always room for improvement. And in hindsight, you know, again, it really improved my practice since the last time we met, and it really, you know, it's affected all of my reports, whether for veterans evaluations, DCS evaluations, competency evaluations. It was a really excellent learning opportunity, and that's why I made the changes.
Thank you.
All right. Any further questions? Dr. Davis-Wilson? Oh, no, I thought your hand was up. All right. Hearing no more questions, the board now is going to take this time to deliberate on this matter. Dr. Myers, you're the lead. Would you like to start with the deliberation?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a couple of points that I'd like us to consider. First of all, Dr. Mysticky and his attorney referenced the previous case that was dismissed. And the difference there being that that was the complaint was submitted by a judge, and there was that had possible concerns about, is this being done appropriately? And the guidance to Dr. Mystickian was that there are some real concerns here, and he was responsive and made changes that made those reports much more appropriate. In this case, however, there is a member of the public complaining and saying that she was negatively affected by that report. And I think that's the distinction to make between these two, that there was potential harm because of that initial report. And yes, Dr. Mystickian did respond once this came to the board, but the harm had already been done. This initial report was submitted into an evidentiary hearing, and we don't know all of the ramifications of that. The other aspect brought up by the attorney in defense of this is that it is not a violation of the ethical code, but when you look at 901C that talks about the exception for not having to interview someone, it clearly states that when psychologists conduct a record review or provide consultation and an individual examination is not warranted or necessary for the opinion, psychologists explain this and the sources of information on which they base their conclusions and recommendations. His revisions did that. This initial one that potentially had an impact did not. And so that was the concern that for which we brought this to the full board. And the CSC suggested that we recommend that a non-disciplinary letter of concern be issued. And the reason for that was because of the responsiveness that he has made changes, but there is still the concern that this impacted the complainant. So those were my thoughts about this.
Other comments?
Dr. Bob.
Dr. Bob.
You know, I've spoken at length with the good doctor on this type of practice and the implications of it. I want to say that he's been incredibly responsive in terms of cleaning it up. I trust him today if he says there are no more of these. I know that there were some of these that were hauntingly hanging in the past. They're not proper. As Dr. Myers points out, in terms of how this practice was conducted, we've got a sacred trust. People trust in us to say the right things, to do the right things, and to protect those innocent kids, to protect and guide families and supporting those kids. And at some level, I believe that's what the doctor was trying to do. I see no evil, no malfeasance, no attempt to do things wrong. So I'm going to stand with my prior comments to the doctor. I think he's taken them to heart. And I agree with Dr. Myers' recommendation of a non-disciplinary letter of concern.
My comments, I have strong I have concerns. I have concerns that and especially a psychologist, which is held to think of high regard, someone can call them and say, hey, this is all this stuff. And then they write all the comments that the ex gave them and then add a couple diagnoses. And I agree with Dr. Gill. I think what's concerning is the diagnostics impressions are actually written in there and are now are part of a court document. And, you know, you're making a judgment on someone who has not even had an opportunity to defend themselves. And I do agree, you know, the best interest of the child is always imperative, but that could have been done without leaving credence or trying, in my opinion, trying to sway a court or trying to provide, hey, this person might have these issues, heads up, when you don't even know. What you've heard is one side. And that's concerning to me.
Yeah, that's damn right.
So you need to be on mute unless you're a board member, please. Dr. Gill?
Madam Chair, thank you. I just would want to make a general statement that the use of diagnoses is an extremely important principle of how psychologists perform their duties in assessment and treatment. And using these words is extremely important and has a lot of significance. When we use diagnostic language, even if we claim that a diagnosis was not rendered, the report was not a diagnostic tool, we have to realize that the use of these terms has a lot of meaning and could cause challenges, and the court could misconstrue the information that was rendered to the court, in this case, the diagnostic impression. So I just want to emphasize that. I'm not real keen on the idea of these consultation summaries, but if he had let go of that language, I could at least say, okay, well, maybe there's a case to be made that he's looking into the welfare of these children and this was the best way to respond. But the use of that language I have trouble with. Having said that, I am in support of Dr. Bob's statement that a non-disciplinary letter is appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gill. Any other comments? All right, hearing none, is there a motion or thoughts on to proceed? This is an initial review to determine if there's enough to move forward, I guess, to a formal.
Yes, Madam Chair. So I would make a motion, and let me, I believe I can say that the case would be dismissed with a non-disciplinary letter of concern. Is that correct, Ms. Govan?
So at this point in the proceeding, because this is initial review, they would have to consent to the issuance of a letter of concern. You could set it for an informal interview, and then if they don't agree to the letter of concern, we could move to that stage.
Ms. Galvin, do they need to consent to that per statute? I thought the letter of concern did not require that, that the board could issue the letter of concern.
That's initial, you may be correct. You are correct. So they could go ahead and we can go ahead and issue the letter of concern at this time. You're correct.
And Dr. Meyer, I would just request that you state what you would like to have included in that letter of concern as well as the other members.
The concern is the insufficient use of the consultation that was not in accordance with APA Code of Ethics 9.01C, and that he has shown responsiveness to this feedback previously and made changes that are appropriate, but that the initial evaluations were problematic.
Should there be comments in there about using diagnosis impressions?
Sure. I think that that's appropriate as well.
All right, so we have a motion.
Would you say something like there needs to be a strong basis for diagnostic impressions, including interviewing the person diagnosed and looking at multiple sources of information? Something like that?
Well, I think the letter is more that he didn't do that.
Right, that's what you would say needs to be done.
Well, if you're doing a consultation like this, you wouldn't necessarily need to interview someone, but you also should not be including those diagnostic impressions.
Right, but I mean, I wouldn't think you could even suggest any diagnosis without interviewing the person or imply or infer.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I thought in the concern, we should say what needs to be done, what the problem was, and what would be the remedy that should be done. But maybe that's not how it's written.
Diagnosis should not be implied in a consultation such as this.
Right. Dr. Gill, did you have something?
Well, there are cases where psychologist in a court hearing might render a diagnosis. I'll give you an example just to maybe for perspective purposes. People that I know that are expert on the MMPI, for example, will go to court and without evaluating the individual, will review the results of the test and then give an opinion to the court about their diagnostic impression. They're not necessarily gathering third-party information. It's just strictly the result of the test.
There wasn't any test. That's the problem.
I'm just giving an example of when that is a proper situation. So there was a lot of concern here about, KP was not evaluated. Well, there are cases in court in the legal arena where this is done. That's all I'm saying. But in this case, I don't think a strong case was made that enough information was gathered. I mean, you're having this good psychologist walking into a a very contentious situation. You're almost asking for trouble when you're gathering information from one side, you're not gathering information from the other side, and then you issue a report. And again, there's concern about maybe the children are not taken care of. Okay, that's a well-meaning intent on a part of the good doctor. But nevertheless, it's a contentious situation. You're walking into a landmine, in my opinion, and better judgment should prevail. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Well, and the initial evaluation did not sufficiently explain the limitations of only taking this information from the ex-husband. It didn't explain why you would not need to collect extra sources of information or an objective psychological test.
I have a recommendation. You know, we can do a non-disciplinary letter of concern with some continuing ed. And I appreciate Dr. Myers' last point of putting the limitations in the report. That is such a critical piece when you're doing these one-sided consultations. So wondering if Dr. Myers would be open to that friendly amendment.
I absolutely. The reason we thought that a non-disciplinary letter of concern was appropriate was because of his responsiveness to the previous interaction. But I think that there's always room for improvement, and additional continuing education would be appropriate. The CEUs would be in addition to renewal requirements and would be focused on psychological evaluations. How many, Dr. Mallott?
Maybe 10.
Okay.
Right. Ms. Galvin, I do have a question. Ms. Galvin, if this is a non-disciplinary letter, if another complaint is filed against this doctor for the same type of behavior, is that then will we be able to reference back to that he's already been in front of this board twice before for this issue?
You may.
Okay.
So just to clarify, to make sure my understanding is correct, Dr. Myers' motion is to dismiss the complaint with a non-disciplinary letter of concern and then a friendly amendment from Dr. Mallott to issue a non-disciplinary order for continuing education. Is that correct?
Yeah, for 10 credits.
What period of time would you require him to complete the CE, and is it may he apply it to what is necessary for renewal?
Dr. Mallott, what are your thoughts?
6 months.
And should it continue?
And in addition to the requirements for renewal.
And I would imagine that the CE may be obtained online or distance education.
That is correct. It's almost impossible right now, yes, for in person.
So that was my motion.
So have a question, please.
Yes, Dr. Mobohansky.
He said call the question.
Oh, I'm sorry, you said you had a question. Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. Do you need a roll call vote?
No.
No. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
I think, Dr. Mallott, you're in favor?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any opposed? I oppose. So one opposed.
And I see that Ms. LaBoy has joined the call.
All right. I don't
Ms.
think
Ms. LaBoy, were
good
you
morning.
Were you present for the entire discussion?
I was, yes. I logged in about a half hour late, but yes, for this I was.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, so the motion carries. You'll be receiving information from our board soon, doctor.
Hey, thank you very much, everybody. All right.
Thank you, everybody, for participating. We're going to now move to item number 8, discussion.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Ho. I would like to give out the first continuing education code word The first word for CE credit will be candy cane.
Candy cane. Very holiday-ish. Candy cane. So please write that down and send that into our board in less than a week, along with any other code words that come out today. So item eight, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding proposed consent agreement and order for voluntary surrender of psychologist license for John Denbor, PhD, in cases number 1622, 1825, 1826, 1902, 1904, 1911, 2017, 2042, 1639, 1653, and 1723, and possible motion to vacate the informal interview scheduled for December 10th. Ms. Executive Director or Ms. Galvin, would you like to provide a summary of the consent decree, or Ms. Michelson?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will provide that summary in a brief overview. As the board is aware, there are 8 pending complaints against Dr. Denbor's license. At the board's meeting on May 8th, 2020, informal interviews were conducted for 3 cases, which resulted in the board finding violations for all of cases. The board held off on adjudicating these cases until the informal interviews for the remaining cases had been completed. On October 22nd of 2020, the board held a special meeting for the purpose of conducting the informal interviews for these remaining cases. On this meeting date, the board discussed that Dr. Denbor's license was currently suspended by operation of law pursuant to ARS 32-3202, as he had not submitted a renewal application by the expiration date and had pending complaints. In response to the board's questions at this meeting, Dr. Denbor relayed that he is currently not living in Arizona and had no immediate plans or intent to practice psychology in Arizona. Based on this information, the board questioned whether Dr. Denbor would be interested in entering into a consent agreement to voluntarily surrender his license. The board recessed to allow the parties time to discuss their options and return to this matter after lunch. After reconvening from lunch, Mr. Hunter, who represents Dr. Denbor, reiterated that Dr. Denbor has relocated from Arizona and has no plans of returning at this time. He requested that the board continue this matter to allow them time to consult with additional counsel to determine whether voluntarily surrendering his license in Arizona would prevent him from applying in any other state. The board suspended the informal interview proceedings to allow Dr. Denbor an opportunity to consult with his legal counsel and to respond to the board's proposal for voluntary surrender. On November 25th of 2020, board staff received a proposed disciplinary consent agreement from Mr. Hunter, which indicated that Dr. Denbor agreed to a voluntary relinquishment of his psychologist license. After reviewing this proposal with Ms. Galvin, a revised consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of Dr. Denbor's license was sent back to Mr. Hunter and Dr. Denbor for their review. This included additions to the findings of fact section and modifications to the order. Mr. Hunter requested a few revisions to this revised version, which Ms. Galvin and staff approved. On December 3rd of 2020, we received the signed consent agreement and order for voluntary surrender from Dr. Denbor, which has been uploaded to the portal for the board's consideration. The consent agreement and order indicates the following. Dr. Denbor's psychologist license is voluntarily surrendered. Upon application for licensure, the board shall reserve the right to review all pending complaints and licensing history and determining Dr. Denbor's qualification for licensure, as well as any terms of probation that the board may wish to order. Whether to grant Dr. Denbor's application for licensure shall be within the sole discretion of the board. This stipulation means that Dr. Denbor would be able to reapply for licensure at any point in the future, but that it would be up to the board to determine if Dr. Denbor should be granted a license and meets the qualifications for licensure. The order also indicated that the cases which are subject of the 2018 consent agreement, which placed Dr. Denbor's license on probation and required him to have a practice monitor, is adjudicated within the entry of this order. The proposed consent agreement for voluntary surrender is before the board today for review and possible acceptance. If accepted, the consent agreement would serve as a final disposition for all cases, and the surrender will be effective as today's date. Due to it being a disciplinary consent agreement, it would be reported to the National Practitioners Databank. Should the board decline to accept the proposed consent agreement, it would proceed with conducting the informal interviews for the 5 cases listed on today's agenda. Dr. Denbor and his attorney were notified of today's meeting and that the board may elect to conduct informal interviews if the proposed consent agreement was not accepted. I do believe that Mr. Hunter is present today. I'm not aware if Dr. Dunbar is here, but this concludes my summary. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nicholson. Mr. Hunter, welcome. And is Dr. Dunbar here today too?
He unfortunately is not on right now. I just have been texting him. He's currently in.
Do you have any comments?
No, other than we took a lot of time in the consent agreement. I think it effectuates the wishes of Dr. Dunbar as well as the board. Dr. Dunbar has signed it, and we request that the board likewise approve the consent agreement.
All right, thank you. Board members, we have all had opportunity to read the consent agreement. Is there any discussion or thoughts or a motion? I think it's pretty thorough.
Dr. Bob. I am most happy to put forth a motion to accept this consent agreement and remove this license.
Seconded.
My motion is that we do that.
And I think I heard Dr. Meyer second it.
A little too early. Second.
I got a motion and a second. Dr. Gill, did you have a comment?
Well, just because Dr. Dunbar is also residing now in another state, I very much wish that the violations that have been determined by this board will act to prevent Dr. Dunbar from being licensed in another state for the appropriate time as well as in Arizona. That's my only concern.
They will be, my understanding that if he applies for a license in another state, that this will be accessible to them because it will be on the national database. Is that correct, Ms. Michelson?
That is correct. We report the surrender to the databank, so they will be able to pull that information.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
You're welcome. All right, so we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion?
We will need a roll call.
Thank you. Ms. Poe, could you do a roll call vote, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Dr. Davis?
Yes.
Dr. Malott?
Yes.
Dr. Bohansky?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Dr. Davy?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Ms. LaBoy?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, so much for your work on these cases. Thank you, Mr. Hunter, for being here today. If you could let Dr. Dunbar know the outcome, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm going to vacate the next item.
Yeah.
So yes. Item number 9 is informal interviews. We no longer need those. I need a motion to vacate that agenda item.
So moved.
I got a motion. I need a second.
Second.
We got a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Again, item 10 is continuation of informal interviews for the Dr. Dunbar related cases. Is there a motion to vacate agenda item number 10?
So moved.
Heard a motion from Dr. Davy. Is there a second?
Seconded.
We got a second from Dr. Meyer. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Perfect. The time now is 10:16. I'd like to take a 10-minute break, a comfort break, and then continue with the rest of the items, which shouldn't take too long. So let's reconvene here at, 10:30. And just take a break, and I'll see everybody back here at 10:30. Please put yourself on mute, turn off your cameras, and take a moment to relax and grab a snack. Have everybody. Do we need a roll call to reconvene?
may be advisable because we're on Zoom.
All right, Ms. Poe, can you do a quick roll call, make sure we're all here? Thank you.
Yes, Madam Chair. Ms. Shreve?
Present.
Dr. Davis-Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Malott?
Dr. Malott?
Present.
Dr. Bohansky?
Here.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
Ms. LaBoy?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
All members are present.
Great, thank you. All right, our next item is item 11, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding Legislative Rules Committee. Ms. Executive Director, would you like to provide a summary of these items and lead us through?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I will.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Meyer.
So I'm going to recuse myself from Agenda 11A due to the possible perception of a conflict of interest because of my employment at ASU. However, I would like to make a statement as a member of the public whenever it would be appropriate.
Okay. All right. Ms. Galvin, thank you for acknowledging or letting us know, Dr. Meyer. I just want to make sure. So as a public member, then when he speaks, just let reconfirm he's speaking as a member of the public.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. Perfect. All right. Ms. Executive Director.
Yes, Madam Chair. I will just introduce each of the items under 11 as we conclude the one that precedes it. With respect to 11A, as this board is aware, over the past several meetings, you have engaged in dialogue with representatives of University of Arizona and Arizona State University, the representatives who are seeking a statute change to ARS 3271 to recognize the Psychological Clinical Science Accreditation System, PCSAS, as an accreditor of psychological education programs. At your last meeting, you asked for those representatives to bring additional information for your consideration, and that information has been supplied. It consists of a copy of the accreditation standards and criteria, a sample accreditation renewal self-study is prepared by the University of Arizona, some FAQ material and a letter of support. And last month with Dr. David Sabara from the University of Arizona, and he has returned and is present for this meeting.
Great, thank you. Is there, Dr. Sabara, did you make you want to make any comments as a guest here?
No, thank you. I just want to introduce Sabrina Vasquez from the University Legislative Affairs Office. She's with us again to recognize that she's here. And then as far as we see it, unless Sabrina has more to add, we're really here to be consultants and answer questions given all the information we've provided to the board.
And I guess just so I can wrap my own head around, is this discussion only? Are we looking at just this is an informational? What are we looking for anything other than that?
Sabrina?
So Chairman, thank you. And members of the board, last time we were here, it was made clear from the members of the board, from my understanding, is that you do not take positions on legislation, and which we understood. We were hoping for a motion of support, but also recognizing that not taking a position is also not opposing the legislation outright at the Capitol. So we do appreciate that. So recognizing that that's the case, we wanted to provide you with an update and answer your questions to hopefully collaborate with you all, because we recognize that this legislation will impact your work. We have not chosen a sponsor yet. We are sort of waiting to see where the committees fell. So we will be moving forward in the next week to select a sponsor, and I'm happy to share that sponsor with your executive director when I have that. Other than that, we really just want to make ourselves available for questions to be as collaborative as possible with this board.
All right, thank you. I do have a question. Have you reached out to your stakeholders regarding your position and potential legislation, and if you have, who were they and what was the responses?
So you being our largest stakeholder, we have reached out to you. We've also reached out to the Psychology Association, the Arizona Psychology Association. The last year, we'll let them know now that we are moving forward, but they're very familiar. Last year, we ran the exact same legislation. They did not take a position on it. We had a robust conversation about what their legislative priorities were going to be. I'm assuming they're moving forward with the same priorities because we are all in the same situation where the legislature wrapped up without really passing any bills because of COVID. And so we'll touch base with them again, but they are very aware, they are briefed, and they have also in previous years taken the position of no position, but they were also very clear that they weren't going to oppose.
All right, thank you. That was my question. Any questions for Dr. Savar or Ms. Valquez? Thank you. And is there any comments from the public on this?
Dr. Madam Martin. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. So I'm stepping back from my position as a board member, and I am speaking solely as a member of the public, a licensed psychologist, and a faculty member in the Department of Psychology at ASU. And beginning in January, I will be the Director of Clinical Training for ASU's Clinical Psychology PhD program. So I just want to share my perspective from a training perspective from ASU's program. We're seeking this statutory change to create parity between PCSAS and APA's Commission on Accreditation, solely for the curriculum requirements for licensure as a psychologist in Arizona. This parity does not change the practicum, internship, or postdoctoral training requirements for licensure, nor does it impact the requirement to pass the ECCC. ASU and U of A provide high quality clinical training, and all of our students match at APA and PCSAS accredited internships and have higher ECCC pass rates than programs not accredited by PCSAS. And in fact, the majority of top ranked clinical psychology programs are PCSAS members. The proposed parity would allow PCSAS programs to improve clinical training in response to advances in psychological science and up-to-date research. But this innovative research-based approach to training is stifled by APA's accreditation requirements. In fact, APA has made some changes to their requirements in response to PCSAS, but more flexibility is needed, which is provided under PCSAS accreditation. As a public member, my perspective, as far as a regulatory concern, PCSAS does not pose any potential harm to Arizona citizens, and in fact may result in a benefit to the public by furthering the development and application of psychological science. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Board members, any comments, thoughts in regards to this? And in the past, we've taken a no position. Dr. Gill.
Well, I just have a quick question. I think one of the representatives said during the last board meeting that you had reached out to NAU with respect to, I believe, perhaps supporting their being more rigorous regarding their curriculum. I think I have that right. And I wonder, could you elaborate on that, on what you do you reach out to different universities to maybe educate them in terms of improving their curriculum and the scientific basis for their training and education programs?
So the last conversation about NAU last year was whether or not they were going to be comfortable with this legislation. That's what we've reached out to them on, and they're actually actively lobbying it for us with us at the Capitol. They are part of the Arizona Board of Airborne Regents University, and as such, they are also engaged in and support this. Obviously, because they don't have a PhD program, they are not as engaged as ASU and ourselves, but they do support it, and they have signed in support of this of the legislation we're discussing right now. As far as their curriculum, their rigor on their curriculum, I think that might have been a little bit of a misunderstanding, but I am happy if you want me to reach out to them on any type of issue or connect them with you, I can. We work extremely closely with both their government affairs team and the provost office.
Okay, well, I'm still trying to understand things. But you do reach out to these programs. I mean, you're making the argument based upon what I read that you want, you know, these graduate programs to be to raise their level of in terms of moving toward a scientific practitioner model for training. And I just wondered if you cooperate with these different programs to make the point that they need to upgrade their training.
Can I answer Dr. Hill?
Yes, sure, of course. Please do.
Please comment.
Yeah. So, Dr. Gill, I first want to correct the UFA, the person present. And he does have a PhD program, so that's... Okay. And I come from NAU. But in terms of educational programs, when changes are made, especially that go before the board, this one is not going before the board. This is going before the state legislature. So it will not come to the provost at the three institutions. But if they are proposing a new program, that would come. And then myself, as the dean of the college, often get those requests to comment on whether I would support or not support. Since this is a legislative matter, it would not come. And so I've stayed on the call and not recused myself. So I just want to say, the one thing about PCSAS is it excludes counseling and school psych type. I think it's primarily clinical, but maybe Dr. Myers can correct me as a public member. I cannot recall that. But it's very specific to clinical psych programs. That's the neat comment I want to make.
Yes, and I will just fill that out. Thank you for the addition that the way the PCSAS accreditation process works is that programs who are interested in applying for accreditation submit initial letter of inquiry. And PCSAS, it does accredit only clinical science programs, so scientist practitioner programs with more of an emphasis on the science. But during this sort of initial inquiry phase, PCSAS has an incubation or development process where they speak with programs about ways to move in that direction if it's something they're interested in. So the accreditation body in and of itself isn't lobbying to promote this type of model across the board. It's accrediting programs that already have this orientation and trying to promote this orientation across the field by virtue of its accreditation standards.
Right, and just to elaborate on that, what I meant was the Board of Regents approves our legislative agenda, and the all government affairs entities from all three institutions are at the table and engage in that discussion. NAU is supportive of it, and like I said, has lobbied as part of the Board of Regents' priorities, and the provost engaged in that conversation as related to the legislation. Now, if you're talking about another program, that is beyond what we do in government affairs. What I was just talking about was this legislation specifically, recognizing that NAU has been at the table through their government affairs team. Their government affairs teams reach out to their experts in the university, but also the provost is engaged in the conversation at the Board of Regents.
All right, thank you. Board members, are there any other questions? Dr. Bohansky.
I guess everybody's waiting for my input on this interesting presentation. I'm going to say several things. Last time we had a presentation, the only part of it that was really important to me was the idea that psychology needs to evolve. The evolution of psychology, I think, is important to our citizens. I think is important to our profession. and I think is important to the training programs that we have. Now, APA has been the monopoly of what psychology is. They are slow to change, and they change in a direction that sometimes many of us disagree with. I do not see APA as leading the charge in evolving psychology. I see them muddled in social justice. I see them muddled in diversity. I see them losing ground in terms of being the monopoly spokesman for the practice of psychology. Second, PCSAS has taken a course of trying to persuade boards one at a time, state by state. And if they look over their shoulder, or this board looks over its shoulder, the association of all the boards, the 64 boards that do what we do, has come out not in support of PCSAS. For us to support this is for us to take a position that is contrary to our colleagues across the nation. The people who spoke in opposition to PCSAS were the executive director and leadership of our fellow boards. I think we need to keep that in mind. Now, there are holes in PCSAS, major holes. They have developed their position through unique methods. And I will not go through the story of how they got APIC accreditation and how they used the VA as an accrediting body to meet that requirement, despite the fact the VA is a troubled healthcare system and not an accrediting body, how they got around the requirement for Department of Education accreditation. They've used some interesting methods, of which I'm opposed. Now, they have a long way to go. In the several years that I have worked on defeating this legislation, I have watched them improve their website, improve their documentation, and become clearer in what they're doing. And I give them kudos for that. There are major problems out there, and some of the way they present themselves is downright deceptive. Every one of those students who passed the EPPP and did well to move on to be a psychologist came out of an APA-approved program, and Dr. Myers knows that. They may have also had PCSAS, but they went through an APA-approved program, every one of them. There is no one online, with the exception of Berkeley, who's very clear that they're going to drop their APA accreditation once California recognizes PCSAS. I'm not in favor of misleading the legislature or the public by saying we're better when in fact your students are doing exactly what we would expect getting a good education from a good school under an accreditation provided by CORE. Now, with all that being said, and with the concerns I have that they continue moving, and they've got some distance to go. If you're a young psychologist with a huge debt and you want to join the military and be a military psychologist, it's explicitly stated that you need to come from an APA-approved program. They've got work to do. Back to my central point. Psychology has to evolve. We need psychologists whose research is not just rat lab, but that's practical in terms of what's best in public health, what's best in policy decisions that affect the future of our disabled children, developmentally disabled, what makes the most sense for those less fortunate. How can we expand psychology in those areas? And if PCSAS is really serious about providing training to psychologists who can do that kind of work, who can grow psychology's stamp input based on research that makes sense, that's a good thing. So to the shock of many, and based solely on the concept that was presented by their representative last time on how they may evolve psychology into areas of public interest, support, and need, I will vote to support including them as an alternative, perhaps not equivalent, as an alternative to APA accreditation for their educational programs.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Bohansky. Board members, I guess the question is, I guess in the past we've taken no position on their legislation. Is there any feeling of difference from anybody in regards to a position being I guess somewhat neutral or any other position? Hearing Dr. Gilley, you need to, I think you're on mute.
I'm sorry. I'm still in a learning mode with respect to PCSAS. At this time, I would support taking a neutral position, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. And again, a neutral position is not a opposing position. It's just more of a neutral position. So am I hearing a consensus then, just maintaining a neutral position? I don't think we need a vote on that. Is that right, Ms. Galvin?
I would prefer a vote so that the interested parties could state one way or the other what the position of the board was, whether it was in favor, opposition, or no position.
And Madam Chair, I would support that as well. If we are asked represent a position or a neutral stance, I would like to effectively represent that because you gave me that direction.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chairman, I move the board support the change in legislation suggested by PCSAS and the Arizona Board of Regents.
If I may, I don't see in the materials that were provided an actual bill or a workup. So I don't know if you want to amend your motion to say that you support the theory or the proposition.
The intention, maybe?
We can also, I apologize, we can also, it's going to look just like the same language as last year. So that's been submitted. However, if you would like us to return to your next board meeting with the actual bill language of the bill number, we're happy to do that in order to be able to receive full support of the board.
Ms. Galvin, what do you think?
That's up to the board. I would just caution the board to vote to support the legislation offered by APCSAS when there is actually no bill in front of you to review.
Okay, good point. So if we were to reference last year's bill, would that, I think what I just heard is that they're submitting the same bill. Is that correct?
If I may, perhaps the to put a point on it, it might be reasonable to say to support the intention to pursue legislation that creates parity. So you would put the intention to pursue, and then that will say we're not supporting the specific legislation, we're supporting what is going on here, what we've come for you.
My concern is I'd rather support something.
I'd like to go ahead and make a motion. I think I can capture what's being said.
Dr. Malott?
Yeah, so my motion would be to support parity in terms of recognizing PCSAS as an alternative to meeting the educational requirements as stated in the licensing requirements of the board. Ms. Galvin, does that sound reasonable?
That would be up to the board.
But that doesn't... Do we need a reference? Does the legislation specifically reference what their requirements are?
No.
No, it creates, it requires the board to also allow PSAS to also allow those who graduate from a PSAS accredited program to sit for the exam as they do for APA.
So that's where the parity comes in. The only thing that we use APA for in our licensing requirements is we do not review every single course line. If they come from an APA approved program, we say they've met the course requirement. That's the only thing we use APA for. Everything else, you have to meet Arizona statutory requirements for licensure.
All right. And Dr. Malott, just a quick question, because I know Dr. Meyer stepped out for the conflict of interest. You're with NAU. There's no conflict with you then?
No, because, APA is still an equivalent. APA is still, all our students fall under the APA requirements. So it's not it wouldn't create a problem for non-PCSAS programs.
Correct.
As I have a motion on the table, I will accept Dr. Malott's revision.
All right, so we have you accept the friendly amendment?
Yes, and ask for a second.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. So thank you both. Comment.
Just note Dr. Meyer's recusal for the record.
Oh, yes. Yes, and Dr. Meyer's recusal for the record. So thank you both for joining us today. Comment. We're now going to move on to item 11B, update on regulation of independent medical examinations by performance by psychologists.
Guess I don't get a comment.
Executive Director?
Yes, Madam Chair. I can give you a progress report relative to this issue. Where we last left it was that the board was interested in essentially replicating the language that exists in the medical board's statutes that allow for an investigation to be conducted
when a complaint is received involving an IME and the complaint is specific only to unprofessional, possible unprofessional conduct or the standard of care and does not involve a dispute over the findings of the IME. As this board is aware, we've been engaging in conversations with the governor's office relative to this matter. The governor's office advised us as part of the stakeholder input process to first seek the input from the professional association, from ASPA. That input was received during the legislative and rules committee meeting on November 30th, and ASPA has indicated they do not have any concerns with us moving forward with introducing language that is similar or identical to that of the other medical boards. What I hope to be able to tell you today was that we have a response from the final stakeholder group, which is the Arizona Industrial Commission. The governor's office has offered to seek the Industrial Commission's input to this issue. And unfortunately, we don't have that back quite yet, but I anticipate it could be received very soon. What this means is that should this board decide to move forward, we may have all the stakeholders' support in order to introduce this legislation, this legislative change.
Great. Thank you. Moving on to item, is there any questions from the board? Thanks. It's great progress. We're getting there, so that's good. Item C.
Yes, Madam Chair. So the way that I've assembled this progress report is to inform the board of what changes that you have approved of to this point, and then also bring forward a couple of new changes, proposed changes. These changes, again, precipitated from the November Legislative and Rules Committee meeting. So I'll just cover the two categories, if you will, very briefly. What you have already approved is essentially the resurrection of House Bill 2224 and all of its elements. And then also you have approved a modification to the statutes 32-2081 and 32-2091.09. The modifications would clarify that not all complaints need to go before the respective review committees, the CSC Complaint Screening Committee, and the CBA, the Committee on Behavior Analysts. It does clarify that there will be instances where staff and board counsel feel that the information received is of a concern, such a concern that the public health, safety, and welfare is at risk. And so we can bypass those committees and go straight to the board for consideration of a possible summary suspension and other actions. So again, those are the changes that have been approved to date. The legislative committee is bringing forward three more requests or has identified three additional modifications. Two of the modifications are specific to the statute 32-2071, qualifications of applicant education and training. What we found was that there is a sentence both in the subsections F6 and in G5 that are problematic in the sense that those sentences, identical sentences, restrict the board's ability to promulgate rule changes that essentially make telepractice less restrictive. So the sentence reads, beginning July 1, 2016, not more than 50% of the in-person supervision may be completed using telepractice supervision as specified by the board by rule. By eliminating that sentence, it essentially gives the board much more latitude in the rules to describe how telehealth practice is to be delivered and what, if any, restrictions you want in place. So the proposal is to strike the sentences from those two subsections of the statute. And I'll pause here in case there are questions or comments.
All right. And do we need a vote from the whole board to go move forward with that? Since it's a recommendation from the Rules Committee?
Yes, please.
Okay. So we're striking the language that limits us with the telehealth. Is there any concern with that? And I would need a motion to move forward with that potential.
I move we move forward with the changes as outlined by the executive director.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Dr. All right, Dr. Meyer, thank you. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none. All right, Ms. Executive Director, second item.
Yes, Madam Chair. So this board has had ongoing conversation about how to effectively and appropriately address the issue of individuals, whether they are applicants, whether or not they have an active application with this board. They have completed their postdoctoral training experience, but they have not yet become licensed. In most, if perhaps all cases, they have yet to pass the ACCP. So what this board has decided is that we need sort of language that requires those individuals to continue to work under the supervision of a licensed psychologist. Previously, we had looked at perhaps adopting a substantive policy statement to establish that requirement. We looked at potentially this language being inserted into the administrative rules. And ultimately, what the Legislative and Rules Committee decided was that this language needs to be in statute. I don't know for certain that it will be a new subsection. I'm envisioning it would be in 32.20.71, a new subsection N, but I would leave this language up to the judgment of the legislative staff drafters of the bill.
So conceptually, this would cover anyone who just hasn't taken the, or passed the ECCP that's still working, that's no longer getting their hours, that they're still supervised and not working on their own, because in essence, then they're a psychologist. And there seems, we found, I think, in the past couple months, that there's this missing link there. So is there any concern with moving forward with language that would cover that so they would be under a supervisor?
I'd like to add a couple of things. I was thinking maybe two things. One is maybe specifying the number of hours. I don't know if we need to do 1 hour for every 20 hours, but maybe say at least once a week for an hour, something like that, regardless of, you know, how much they practice. As long as they're in practice, they have regular weekly supervision. And the second thing I would like to add is, we also have the payment clause, but since this is not for their licensure, but just under supervision, would we hold them accountable if they're paying for that supervision? So that's a point I just want us to discuss. So
do they pay for supervision?
No, they cannot. But once they're completed with the required hours as required, say if they continue in their status, what is, you know, I think we need to address that because it could become an issue.
Okay, so if you're not now under your required hours, I just haven't passed my ECCP or taken it, then I would like pay someone in essence, maybe a fee to be my supervisor.
I don't think we will specify that, but we don't want to hold them as violating a board standard if they do pay.
There you go.
Okay.
Dr. Bob? This is a conundrum, in that I don't know that we've got the authority as a board to tell a psychologist in practice that, hey, you've committed and you've finished your 2-year commitment of supervising this person, and now the board is going to hold you responsible to continue supervising this person. I don't know that we've got that authority. They've signed documents. They've agreed to supervise them through a postdoc, and now they're hanging out there and they're looking to work. They're not a psychologist. Do we have the ability to force a psychologist to continue to supervise them?
I don't see it as forcing the psychologist that oversaw them for their required hours. I think if I finish my required hours and I just haven't passed or haven't taken the ECCP, I need to find somebody that's going to supervise me.
If you could let me finish, yes. That's why I would like the language to change, since they are out there as essentially a behavioral health technician, that they are appropriate to be supervised by any licensed behavioral health professional, that we don't have the authority to force them on a psychologist. It's their responsibility to act ethically and properly and find a licensed behavioral health professional to supervise them through this period of time. So I think it, and this is what's actually happening. You have these postdocs sitting out there in agencies who haven't finished. The primary agencies are, the primary staff in those agencies are counselors and social workers who are licensed, and they're working under those directors and those coordinators and those technicians that are licensed by the Board of Behavioral Health. So in and all that, they finished all of our requirements. Really what the requirement should be now is that they work under the supervision of a licensed behavioral health professional. And I don't believe that needs to be a psychologist since they've met all their psychology terms, nor do I believe we have the authority to force a psychologist. They should be able to work under what an agency says is their supervisor, and an agency to get reimbursed is going to say your supervisor is this behavioral health professional who's licensed. And I think our language should read licensed behavioral health professional.
Oh, and I do apologize. I thought you were finished before. I do have concerns about that, because if you're then being supervised by a non-psychologist and someone files a complaint, you know, how can a social worker or a behavior analyst be able to supervise a psychologist if they don't know the practice and standards?
I would argue that it's the responsibility of the person practicing to know those standards.
And I would think, though, they haven't passed the EPPP, they haven't passed the standards that we require for them to be on their own as a practicing psychologist. So in essence, if we just allow anyone to supervise them, that's a behavioral health person, then they are practicing as a psychologist without having passed all of the requirements, without someone supervising them that understands psychology.
That's the mistake. They're not practicing as a psychologist. They're practicing as a behavioral health technician. They have no standing to practice as a psychologist. They are practicing as a technician under the supervision of a behavioral health professional. This is why we put this damn thing in place to start with. We put the temporary and license in place because our candidates were essentially behavioral health technicians. So we gave them a temporary license so they'd become behavioral health professionals. If in fact they don't pass in that grace period of the temporary license, they revert to being behavioral health technicians. Who is supervised as a behavioral health technician? Anyone who does not have their license completed and as such can still work in the field as a technician, but has to be supervised by a behavioral health professional of some sort. And all I'm saying is we're recognizing what in fact the practice is. There are behavioral health professionals supervising psychology applicants who have yet to finish their requirements. And because they didn't finish them, their official standing in the community, in the agencies, is as a technician. And we're just recognizing that, in fact, they've got to keep being supervised by a behavioral health professional in that organization.
So just as the non-psychologist here, what is the difference between what a behavioral health technician does and the psychologist?
They can perform all the behavioral health functions that they're doing. They're running groups and they're seeing people individually, and they're involved in the practice of behavioral health, but they can't do it independently, so they have to do it in conjunction with someone's license. And 9 times out of 10, that's going to be a behavioral health professional of some sort other than a psychologist.
other comments?
I have a couple of points. One is there's some things that only psychologists do, such as psychological assessments, and a behavioral health definition could not support the supervision of that. And I know people in the agencies will continue to do assessments. So it needs to be an appropriately credentialed behavioral health professional. Maybe would be the better language, because then the psychologist or the unlicensed psychologist will seek the right type of supervision. And second, I think one thing that maybe we have not done is I'm wondering how other boards handle this across the country, and maybe we need to do some research on that. So,
Heidi, do you have any comments? Do you know anything about that?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that research. I don't know that information right now.
All right, thank you. A good suggestion, Dr. Mallott. Any other comments?
Madam Chair.
Oh, go ahead.
Dr. Myers and then Dr. Catarino.
So when someone is under the temporary license and they do not pass the ECPP, does the temporary license end at that point, or does it continue for a certain period of time?
Ms. Michelson?
It's good for a couple of years. So I think it ends after 2 years. So, but it could, Ms. Folks might know that.
Madam Chair, board members, the temporary license is good for 3 years. It cannot be renewed or extended or reissued. But it's a 3-year license.
So I could apply for a temporary license, take the ECPP after a couple months, not pass it, but still then be under the temporary license for over 2.5 years.
Correct.
I think that's the aspect that we need to address, is that, they're required to have, I think that's the gap, though, that we can address, is that they are required to be under supervision throughout that time, even if they psychological supervision, as long as that temporary license is in effect, even if they don't reapply to take the ECPP.
But not everybody gets a temporary license, right?
Right. And I think that those people that don't get the temporary license is being addressed by what Dr. Bohansky is saying. But the other missing component is that ongoing temporary license.
Can't we just require everybody to get a temporary license? Once you're past the hours required that you need to get a temporary license, and it's good for 3 years. Dr. Catarino, I know you had your hand up.
Well, yes, number one was a behavioral technician, you call them that. There's no regulatory board for them. So what happens if they do make an ethical violation? Who would investigate that?
The person who's supervising them, the behavioral health technicians, have to be supervised by a licensed behavioral health professional. And if they're supervised by a counselor or a social worker, it's the Board of Behavioral Health. There's no board for them. You're absolutely right. That's why we tie them up with, attach them to someone who's licensed and can watch what they're doing. In response to Dr. Mallott's thing, yes, one of the things they can't do is testing, because right, that person who's supervising them is not qualified for psychometric evaluation. So absolutely right. They practice within their scope. They practice within the scope of the behavioral health professional. And that, quite frankly, folks, is how it's being done all over the state right now.
Yeah, well, I could, maybe that is being done. I agree with Tammy that I think that they should be supervised by a psychologist, and that they would not be forced. They would find someone that would supervise them. I also agree with Dr. Meyer that they should get I don't know if this is your point, but I think they should get a temporary license, and it would be a clock of 3 years, because I know some people that have done this for years, just never took the test and just stayed working in a position. And they put down a PsyD or PhD, and people that the public thinks that they are licensed. So they also would have to have a caveat that they have a temporary license under their name. So I just, and I don't, and that's the other point, I don't think they should pay their supervisors either. I think that's a conflict of interest. So that's my points.
And I do like the idea of a temporary license as being a part of the licensure process, because that does put then regulation of all these people under our jurisdiction. Right. And so it does tighten that up and allows us to provide regulatory guidance for...
This is Dr. Malat.
Yeah, I agree.
I think if you're discussing the temporary license process, I think this does need to go back to the legislative committee, because that was not quite the intention of this discussion. We were just talking about the supervision element, and that's a bigger discussion that does need to happen.
I would feel more comfortable if a psychologist is supervising them, because they know what that person should be doing, you know, following those areas. But I'd look for, you know, looking. Any other thoughts? Is there a concern with having the, if once you finish your hours of requirement and now you're in that limbo, that you need to have a temporary license to practice?
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Davey. I would just like to make one statement, and I think it goes to a point that both Dr. Malat and Dr. Bohansky spoke of, and that is that whether or not we have, one, the mechanisms or the ability to put this in place, I still think that's a standing question that I think we need board staff to perhaps look at. And I think Dr. Malat made that point that maybe we need to see how other states kind of deal with this interim period where, you know, where they're kind of in limbo. And I'm concerned that we are creating kind of a monster here out of something that perhaps other states have solved in easier fashion. We seem to be looking to kind of like, you know, essentially write policy or procedure to get out of this. And maybe there's a potential secondary path we could look at given some time. So I'm just concerned that we're moving this forward with perhaps maybe just not having enough information. And I speak to this because it not only impacts psychologists, but it could also impact behavior analysts that have national certification but are waiting for their licensure to go through for the state. As now all of a sudden, are we going to be beholden to providing them additional supervision, even though they have a national certification that is more than viable to practice in many states? And so I just would like to have some more information before we go down the path. I'm not opposed to any of the ideas that have been here. I just don't feel informed enough to go marching down one particular lane.
All right. So is there a consensus that we put this on January's agenda or February? I mean, I don't think it's going to go forward this year by any means. And then give the staff time to look and see how other states are dealing with it. As mentioned earlier, there's 46 other or 64 other committees like this. Let's see how they're handling it. Is that okay with everybody? Okay. I see some nodding. So I feel a consensus.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right, so let's move forward with that. So we look forward to hearing what the board finds out about that. Moving on to item 12.
I'm sorry, I forgot. I should have said this at the top of the agenda item, if I may. We have secured Senator-elect Nancy Bartow's sponsorship on the bill that we will, or possibly bills that we will be bringing forward. Again, there's a lot of speculation about what the legislative session will look like or what it won't look like, but at least we know that we have that support. So I'll keep everyone informed as we know more.
Perfect. Moving to item 12, discussion consideration.
Madam Chair, this is Ms. Poe. Can I give out the next CE code word real quick, please?
Code word, everybody. Get your pen ready.
All right. The next CE code word is snowman. Snowman.
Snowman, as in frosty. Frosty snowman. So we have, I guess I shouldn't repeat the first one. So we have snowman. So again, you have two code words so far. Send those to the board within a week. All right, moving to item 12, possible discussion, consideration, and action regarding licensure and regulatory issues relative to COVID-19. Do you have any update?
Madam Chair, I do not have any updates. If the board has any questions or concerns to raise, you know, now is the time to do that.
Any questions or concerns? All right. Moving on to my favorite item, item 13, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding elections for 2021 for the officers. This matter is on the agenda by statute. The board shall annually elect from its members individuals to serve as chair, vice chair, and secretary. Executive Director, will you please report on interest that you received so far and who's willing to serve as officers?
As of today, I have two self-nominations. They consist of Dr. Davis Wilson expressing an interest in serving in any capacity that is needed. That includes chair. And Dr. Davey has stepped forward to indicate he is willing to serve as the vice chair or as the secretary.
All right, so let's take these one at a time. And I'm glad Dr. Davis Wilson nominated herself because I was going to nominate her. So are there any other nominations for chair? Hearing none, is there a motion to have Dr. Davis Wilson be our chair for next year? I got one motion. I need a second.
Seconded.
And we got a second and a big all in favor.
Aye.
And you can vote for yourself, Ms. Dr. Davis Wilson. And any opposed? All right. Yay. Congratulations. Looking now at the vice chair, we had Dr. Davies is nominated. Is there any other nominations? Hearing none. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Motion and a second. And a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Woohoo! All right, now moving to the next position, secretary, which is a very busy position. Just kidding. We don't have anybody nominated, so I could close my eyes and put my finger on the screen. And
I'd like to nominate Dr. Myers.
Dr. Myers, you've been nominated. We're not going to unmute you, so you cannot say no.
Moved.
So, Dr. Myers, I'm hoping you're good.
Dr. Myers,
when I said I appreciated Dr. Malott's mentoring at the beginning of this meeting, I'd like to retract that. All right, I will accept that nomination.
And I think it's important that there's a psychologist too on the board.
Otherwise you're going to just have a bunch of behavior analysts deciding what's going on, Dr. Myers, so you better get involved.
Hey, I'm okay with that.
For the general public.
Trust your judgment.
All right, so we have a motion for Dr. Meyer as the secretary. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Got a motion and I got a second from Dr. Catalino. All in favor? Is there a discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Well, very exciting. So next year, Dr. Davis Wilson's chair, Dr. Davey is vice chair, Dr. Meyer is secretary. And I have to say, Dr. Davis Wilson, when I took this position, I thought it's going to be super easy because Dr. Bohansky made it look like a breeze, right? It's a lot of work. So just heads up on that. Dr. Bohansky just made it look way too easy. But I congratulate.
I like how you said that after the voting was done.
I congratulate all of you. I think you'll really, really enjoy it. And I have a pleasure. Thank you for putting up with me this year as chair. Like always, it's always a learning experience. I think that concludes. Are there any agenda item 15, any items for the future meetings?
Dr.
I wanted
to thank you for being a good chair. Thank you for being such a good chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for doing such a great job this year.
Thank you, Cammie. You've done wonderful. And could I make one comment that I forgot to make earlier?
Yes.
I just wanted to talk to Ms. Pakkinen for working so hard on my nomination. She's the one who put the materials, and I forgot to thank her. So I do want to thank her publicly for her work.
Yes, she makes us all look good. So thank you. Thank you. Yes, she did a great job.
Anytime, as I keep saying, regulators don't get the recognition that they're due. So this was a pleasure to work on for you.
And you. Heidi, have you been nominated for that committee through ASPPB that you were interested in?
Yes, Dr. Gill. I've been appointed to the annual meeting planning committee and also the disciplinary issues committee.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
Looking forward to it.
Well, congratulations on that. All right. Well, I'm not hearing any items for future meetings. Is there a motion to adjourn for the whole year? 2020 is over almost. Hopefully next one's better. Is there a motion? Got a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Got a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, you guys have a great holiday and we'll see you next year. And thank you so much for your support this year and patience with me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.